It is time now for Your Legal Rights with your host, Jeff Hayden.
Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host is retired San Francisco attorney David Bigelizen. Tonight's broadcast is the first, hopefully the first of many, in collaboration with the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
For the past 35 years, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been defending digital privacy, free speech, creativity, and innovation, transparency, and security, long before most of us saw the link between technological innovation and the erosion of many of our liberties, imagining what the future could look like when we get there, get things right. Unfortunately, things don't always get right, whether in the realm of surveillance, such as, for example, when the Sacramento Power Authority has installed electric power meters and is providing information to law enforcement about people's power usage without a warrant and without telling the customers. Police have been using Ring footage to spy on protesters and obtain footage without a warrant or consent of the user. It's easy to imagine that law enforcement officials will use their renewed access to Ring information to find people who have had abortions or track down people for immigration enforcement. The issues are many. Tonight, two EFF attorneys are here. That's EFF attorney, Electronic Foundation, are here to discuss some of the issues emerging where the law and technology intersect, and particularly the implications on technology and privacy. Tonight's discussion includes such issues as search of your electronic devices at the border, customs and border protection policy, and Fourth Amendment law. Fourth Amendment law means the right to be free from search and seizure related to these searches. What constraints are there upon the ability of law enforcement to search or sell your phone or social media? To what extent can retailers use surveillance to monitor your travel? Your purchase is set pricing in accord. We're talking about consumer privacy. Just when we thought we had a handle on so many such issues, in comes artificial intelligence.
Most importantly, what can we do about it? We need new tools, perhaps new laws, to respond to this new era. Tonight, as always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topics. However, and while you're never limited on this broadcast to the exact point we may be in our conversation, I'd be remiss if I weren't to point out just how highly specialized is the evolving areas of privacy, much less electronic privacy. And please bear in mind that our guest can't provide you a precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. However, we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. Their legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their employers or their clients, but they are here to help. David, let's tell our listeners just who is joining us tonight. Start us off.
We have an illustrious group of speakers this evening, beginning with Sophia Cope. She is a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation Civil Liberties team. She works on a variety of free speech and privacy issues. Key topics include border searches of electronic devices, surveillance, and human rights, the right to record the police Section 230, and student speech and student privacy online. She has been a civil liberties attorney for two decades and has experience in both litigation and policy advocacy. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Slate, and Huffington Post. Welcome.
Victoria Noble is a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She works on a wide array of intellectual property and civil liberties issues arising from the use of emerging technologies. Tori came to the Electronic Frontier Foundation from Denton's U.S. LLP, where she maintained an active litigation and counseling practice centered on First Amendment, privacy, and intellectual property issues. And while tonight's broadcast is largely devoted to privacy, Tori and Sophia are also versed in various free speech, First Amendment, transparency, and copyright issues. And without further ado, Tori, Sophia, welcome to both of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Why don't we begin, Sophia, by talking about some general legal principles. That is, what is a search warrant? Generally, when is it required? And is there a distinction between general requirements for search warrants and searches at the border?
Yeah, so the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibits the government from accessing our personal papers and personal places without a warrant. And the underlying standard is reasonableness. But generally, a warrant is required, and that's an order from a judge specifically stating the thing to be searched or the place to be searched or the thing or things to be seized. And that's usually based on preliminary evidence, on including a sworn affidavit from the, investigator or police officer, showing that there is probable cause. So, you know, some likelihood that some evidence of criminality is going to be in the place that's going to be searched.
Is there any difference in those circumstances at the border?
Yeah. So, over a century ago, the U.S. Supreme Court created what is known as the border search exception to the warrant requirement. And essentially what that means is that in modern times we have Customs and Border Protection, but sort of over the decades, you know, generally customs officers have had the right to search people's belongings in the pre-digital world. That, of course, was luggage and, you know, other kinds of bags and conveyances like cars and maybe wagons back in the day. And the primary purpose for these searches that, again, can be conducted without a warrant is to enforce customs laws. So essentially, the Supreme Court said that the government can look in people's luggage, for example, for things that are either considered contraband, so illegal things that we don't want to be brought into the country, including weapons and drugs and maybe, you know, infested agricultural products, but also things, most importantly, subject to duties. We've been hearing a lot about tariffs in the last several months, and customs enforcement includes that. And that means that officers can find things that are being imported or sometimes also exported and are subject to taxes. And so those are not purposes that are related to general law enforcement. And so the Supreme Court has said that generally a warrant is not required.
And we've talked a bit about warrant requirements and searches. And again, talking in general terms, there are some areas that don't have that same level of a warrant requirement, schools, airports, and the like.
Right, exactly. And those situations are generally called sort of administrative searches or special needs searches, where the primary purpose of the search is to advance, you know, a societal interest that the primary purpose is not criminal law enforcement. I was going to say it has nothing to do with law enforcement, but sometimes there can be ultimate law enforcement action. So, you know, drug testing in schools, for example, those can happen without a warrant. I mean, typically that would be considered a search. But the Supreme Court has said that those can happen without a warrant because the primary purpose is to make sure that athletes are safe on the field and are healthy. Or DUI stops. Those are also considered searches that are permissible without a warrant because the primary purpose is to prevent accidents on the road, to ensure roadway safety. While there might be prosecutions for DUIs that might flow from that, the primary purpose of the warrantless search is not criminal law enforcement. So those can happen without a warrant. So border searches are sort of in the same kind of vein and sort of category as those other kind of special needs or administrative searches.
How does this relate to your devices? it's clear we're all used to going through the airports, and if we have a laptop, unless you have a frequent traveler number, you have to open your laptop and at least show it light up and show that it really is a laptop. Where is that line drawn, as opposed to going in and getting data from it?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question, because there are two, as you say, two different possible aspects to a device search. One is to search the physical aspects of a device. So as you say, to turn it on to make sure it's a legitimate device and is not actually a bomb, or to search other parts of it. So for example, to make sure there aren't drugs being smuggled in the laptop battery compartment. Those are totally legitimate warrantless searches. The problem happens or occurs when the Customs and Border Protection want to get into the data on a device. And so that's a whole new sort of category of search in our mind.
Well, that's actually what we want to talk with you about, and that is, number one, what happens when people cross the border? What does the Border Protection agent, the customs agent, do and say when you have a laptop or a cell phone? What do they say when they want to look at it? What do they say to the traveler? And what's the traveler's response? And what's the scope of the government's permitted investigation into these devices?
And most importantly, what should be the traveler's response?
Okay, those were a lot of questions, gentlemen.
One at a time.
We'll break it down.
One at a time. In your order.
So just to sort of set this scene, for those of us who have traveled internationally, we know that you come back into the country and you have to present your passport, and also you grab your luggage right from the conveyor and you bring it over and you present yourself in the first instance to a CBP agent. Of course, you have to prove that you're entitled to come into the country. Your passport should do that if you're an American citizen. And then they'll ask you, oh, do you have anything to declare? Maybe you bought some gifts or whatnot overseas. You've written that on the declaration form. They ask you, why did you travel? Where did you go? Who did you stay with, et cetera, et cetera? And it should be fairly quick, you know, most of the time, and you just pass through what's called the primary inspection. If for whatever reason or no reason at all, they decide that they want to further question you and look in your luggage, they will pull you into what's called secondary inspection. So in an airport, that typically is just like sort of another room, you know, off to the side, you know, in the general customs area. And once you're in that room and you have your luggage there and you're with the officers, then that's when things can get interesting. They might only ask you some additional questions. They might only look in your luggage to make sure you're not carrying more currency than you're allowed to have, or you're not actually carrying any kind of, like I said earlier, goods subject to import duties, or of course contraband like drugs. But then they might ask to look at your devices. Are you traveling with any devices? You should never lie to a federal agent, so of course you can say yes. And then the sort of major decision point is when they ask you to unlock your device or provide your passcode. And that's really where it can get tricky for people based on their immigration status and different interests they have. And I'm happy to go into those. But
well, let me ask you, if the customs agent asks the traveler to unlock his device or provide his passcode, does he have the right to say no?
The short answer is yes, but that is the critical decision point and the most important personal factor. And we have some guidance on our website at EFF.org, where we talk about this in a lot of detail. But the most important factor is a person's immigration status, and if you're an American citizen, you have an absolute right to reenter your own country. However, if you're a lawful permanent resident with a green card, while you do technically also have a right to enter the United States, we have seen this current administration find lots of excuses to challenge people's green card status. And then if you are a sort of traditional non-citizen where you're coming here on a visa or coming here through the visa waiver program, CBP has a lot of discretion to deny you entry, and failing to comply with a request to unlock your device could potentially lead to a denial of entry for visa people coming here on a visa, or like I said, on the visa waiver program. And it could lead to sort of more headaches for LPRs. But American citizens, therefore, I mean, you know, ultimately American citizens have the most leverage to not comply. But that doesn't mean there won't be consequences. They will be. They have to be let back into the country. But
maybe
they
not
might,
so your device.
But they might be detained, and their device might be confiscated. I mean, detained for, you know, several hours and questioned, not arrested, but detained for several hours. They might have travel delay, and be subject to additional questioning. And the device ultimately can potentially be confiscated for a few hours or even weeks or months after the traveler has left the airport or the border.
Can they confiscate the device for no reason whatever, or do they need to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause? What sort of legal basis does the government need in order to take this property that belongs to someone?
Well, I should clarify that there are two issues. There's the search of the data. So assuming you unlock your device, there's the search of the data.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a potential confiscation of the device. And their policies do say that they should have some reason to actually take the device. But for the original search, that can just actually happen on premises, sort of right there in the secondary inspection room at the airport. The CBP policy, the currently operative policy, which is from 2018, says that for a manual search, which is where they're just sort of mousing or tapping through the device, scrolling, whatever, that they don't need any suspicion whatsoever. For a forensic search, when they want to plug in another device into your device to use sophisticated software to either copy the hard drive in its entirety or to conduct sophisticated data analysis, that their policy says that they have to have reasonable suspicion that there's data on, well, actually not even data on the device, reasonable suspicion that the traveler has violated laws that CBP is authorized to enforce. And so a lot of times that doesn't even mean that there's reasonable suspicion that there's data on the device that's of interest to CBP. It could be that they found something suspicious physically in the luggage, and they're just going to use that as an excuse to get into the device, even though there's no obvious connection that what's in the luggage is going to reflect digital data on the device.
And just for our listeners that are not attorneys or are not familiar with criminal law, when we discuss reasonable suspicion or probable cause, we're talking about just how sure somebody has to be that there's something inside. When they actually know it, you're really talking about probable cause. Probable that you're going to find X, Y, and Z in there. Reasonable suspicion is a much lower standard. You have to have a reasonable, articulable, individualized suspicion. And we're talking about just how certain somebody has to be.
Yeah, and reasonable suspicion is basically less than 50% confidence. You know, it could be, I don't know, we hate to put percentages on these things, but, you know, there definitely isn't more likely than not probability. It can be quite a low standard, but it's supposed to be more than zero suspicion.
And so, these are not standards that are particular to electronic privacy or anything really specific to our show tonight. This is generally the principles that guide in criminal law in general and how much privacy you have a right to from your government.
But I wanted to add that or clarify that what I just explained is reflective of CBP policy. But we should not forget that there is the Fourth Amendment, and Fourth Amendment standards obviously are supreme, right? I'm trying to avoid saying Trump, but they trump agency policy. I mean, I'm sorry, the Fourth Amendment trumps agency policy, but it's true. So what we've tried to do at EFF, and we've partnered several times with ACLU and other orgs, is to try to bring a Fourth Amendment analysis to this question of device searches and per our opening discussion, really tried to argue that the traditional border search exception to the Fourth Amendment allowing warrantless searches of luggage and cars is inapplicable or should be inapplicable to devices because it's just a whole other category of personal property where the privacy interests are just, you know, vastly, vastly more, right? Vastly more significant. The volume of data is much more, right? So if you think about the privacy interest in a piece of luggage, you might have a personal diary in there. You might have a personal letter or something like that, but it's not likely. And even if you do have it in there, it's going to be very limited in terms of what it's going to reveal about you. Typically, you're going to have your toiletries and your shoes and your clothes and maybe some gifts or, like I said, or souvenirs that you brought from over from your trip. But the privacy interest as a category of property, right? The privacy interest in luggage and cars are very, very minimal. And devices are just a whole other scenario.
The courts went through a similar analysis when looking at cell phone searches. And in 2010, California Supreme Court said, oh, no, this is all good. If you had it with you when you're under arrest, well, who cares if it tells you about Aunt Millie's medical conditions and the various things that you want to keep private. We're on to more important things. That lasted a few years until the United States Supreme Court reached the same issue, and they felt quite differently. And now the law of the land is generally you have a pretty good right of privacy in your cellular telephone. Does it look as though, is it hopeful that your other electronic devices are going to be treated similarly, or have we really reached the high water mark, do you think, and now we start watching the rights erode?
Yeah, so you're talking about Riley versus California, and that was over a decade ago, and it was a seminal Supreme Court decision that said, as a general matter, at the interior of the country, police need a warrant to search people's cell phones. And we have argued that Riley should also apply at the border because probably more than half of the discussion in Riley by Chief Justice Roberts was about the privacy interest in cell phones. And the privacy interest in cell phones at the interior of the country are no different than the privacy interest in cell phones at the border. The question is, what are the government's interests in getting at that data? And we argue that even though there are two different scenarios, sort of in Riley, it was actually related to an arrest and getting the cell phone after an arrest. But we argue that really the government's interest, even though the different scenarios, arrest and the border, that the government's interests are really quite weak in getting at data. Because if you look at the traditional justifications for the border search exception, particularly customs enforcement, where the goal is to interdict the actual physical goods to prevent them from entering the country, that just doesn't make any sense when you talk about digital data.
Why wouldn't somebody want to just take, if you have the wherewithal to buy it, just to buy a burner phone, or if you're going to bring a laptop, buy a notebook that has no hard drive, that's internet-based, such as a Chromebook, and leave your computers and your regular cell phones at home?
Yeah, so you're asking about tips and tricks to sort of protect your privacy when bringing devices across the U.S. border. Like I said, we have some guidance online that goes into this in quite a lot of detail. We do urge people to have a plan before they travel, both, you know, leaving the country, obviously, and then coming back, because really each person's plan is going to be different. So, yes, a burner device or a temporary travel device, whether phone or laptop, is definitely a possibility. But maybe someone's traveling to an area where they don't have good internet access. Maybe they're on a research expedition or something like that, right? So that may not, sort of using a device where they have to pull their data from the cloud may not be very practical. So we encourage people to think about lots of different factors related to their interests, you know, what they need, and to come up with a plan and to really think about the risks that they face. So those include the likelihood of being pulled into secondary inspection in the first place, Of course, what we're talking about is government access to data. So that's perhaps the most important thing to try to think about and try to minimize. But maybe you also really have concerns about being detained and missing your connecting flight or otherwise having travel delay. Maybe you're a non-citizen, as I said, and are concerned about a denial of entry. Maybe you're concerned about having your device confiscated and losing your data. We tell all people to back up their data, right? But if you fail to comply, and like I said, the key decision point is when you're asked to unlock your device or provide your passcode. We generally tell people if you're going to do it, just don't give them your passcode, just unlock the device. You have to decide what you're going to do in that moment. And for some travelers, unlocking to sort of smooth the process, right, to maybe have less confrontation with CBP officers, to try to mitigate against travel delay or denial of entry, maybe they're going to decide to unlock their device if they're asked. But if they're going to do that, then they have to decide, well, how do they prepare the device for that possibility? And then it's about, well, what data do you minimize on the device? What data do you absolutely need access to when you're traveling? And like I said, all of these considerations are highly individualized.
As I tell people, in a more land-based model, it's not always what you're trying to hide. Maybe you're not trying to hide anything. Maybe you haven't done anything wrong. But the process of getting to where the person you're dealing with realizes that can be quite extended and quite painful. And the idea of avoiding that, not having to be subjected to interrogation and sit there for some time, has a tremendous value to it.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, let's talk a little bit about traveling. There's a fundamental constitutional right to travel, but people have cell phones. Can people track where you're going or where you're coming by your cell phone?
Which people?
Well, let's talk about the government for the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's retrospective location data, maybe getting information from your cell phone provider, and that generally requires a warrant per the Supreme Court. There's also prospective, you know, sort of live tracking, and that typically is going to fall under the Wiretap Act. But there are, thankfully, laws in place that that protect, mostly protect you from sort of excessive government access to your location. But we have seen, and maybe Tori can talk about this, but we have seen government entities buy location data. In the private sector, we've seen location data be sort of bought and sold. So that's a separate issue.
Okay. How about if the government wants to gather information about people's emails and information that's on email? What do they have to do for that?
Well, generally, both the Fourth Amendment and what's called the Stored Communications Act require a warrant to get access to content stored by service providers sort of in the cloud. And we would like that statute and even case law to be stronger on that. But the Justice Department, or at least I don't know about this current Justice Department, but over the last several years, the Justice Department has consistently agreed that they should get a warrant.
But there's some other stuff that they can get without a warrant and with a much more shallow showing, isn't that right? Such as whom you're calling and when and so forth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, under the Stored Communications Act, there are different standards. So just with sort of a mere kind of administrative subpoena, they can just get basic subscriber information. So, you know, who you are and like your payment method and, you know, just generally data about your account. More detail, like you were saying, about maybe who the metadata, who you're communicating with, sort of the header information, that kind of thing, requires a little bit of a higher showing, kind of more along the lines of a reasonable suspicion standard. So yeah, there's sort of different levels of data when you're talking about online material.
So if they go into my account and they find out that I'm communicating with Meyer Lansky or Dutch Schultz, that would be the basis for a warrant, and they'd then go in and get everything else that I had with those gangsters, right?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, definitely metadata can be quite revealing. So that is always a possibility that it can be can lead to further investigation.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. This is KALW, and now we return to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by tonight's co-host David Bigelizen. Tonight, we're talking about privacy in the digital age. Appearing courtesy of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, my guests Sophia Cope and Tori Noble are here to help. If you have questions from our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And we have been focusing until now about the government. It's not just the government that has eyes on us, is it?
No, private companies also have access to an incredible amount of personal information. Often it's the information that you may input into the computer when you're making a purchase, for example, filling out a web form. But often it's information that you may not know that you're sending. So potentially your location from your phone. As you take these devices with you throughout your day, often it can send your location information to companies that then can buy and aggregate and sell that information. Other sources of information too, even if you just Google search something, often where you go online will be tracked by third parties who use technologies called cookies or trackers or pixels, and they use that to follow you around and determine where you've gone online.
You know, I had a very strange experience a few years back. I walked into a store, did not make contact. The lines were much too long. I saw one salesperson. I left. I went into another store a few miles away to make the same purchase. As I arrived at store number two, I started getting flooded on my phone with ads and emails from store number one. Are they watching us that closely that when your phone breaks the plane of someplace, they know you're there?
They can be. It depends by the company and by the store, but there is an example, and again, the company denied it, but there's an example from a few years ago where Target, again, allegedly, was tracking whether, when you used the Target app, they were tracking whether you were in their parking lot or further away and charging different prices depending on how close you were to their store.
So they kind of knew if you were in the parking lot, you mean business, yeah. And they can charge you more than someone they're trying to lure into the store.
Yes.
Tori, to me, a cookie is made out of oatmeal and raisins. What does a cookie mean in computer vernacular?
Your cookie sounds more fun. Online, cookies are small bits of text that websites will download onto your device, usually your web browser, when you go to a website, and then when you go to a different website, they can, not always a different website. It can be either on that website or on others, but it will collect that information to identify you as the user and figure out what you're accessing, whether, for example, you're logged in to the website, your security credentials, or it could even be something like a tracking cookie, which big companies like Google, which can install tracking code on lots of different websites through their ads, will collect that cookie that they installed on your device to determine that you, a specific user, are the one who looked at these shoes on this date and these other shoes on this website on a different date, and therefore we think you're interested in these types of shoes.
What can I do to stop that?
There are lots of tools you can install. EFF has one called Privacy Badger that users can install in their browser, and then it will help block many of the cookies that websites are installing to track you across the web.
Does it really help to have a browser such as DuckDuckGo or one of the others?
Some browsers do say that they limit the amount of information that they're sharing with third parties, and then also the kinds of information that they're using to generate, for example, the ads they serve on you. It can help. Often having tools, so a lot of times the information that is being used to track you is not necessarily installed by just your Google search, although you do reveal a lot of information when you search for things in your browser. There's also quite a lot of information that you would be revealed about you just by browsing the internet. So it's not just what you type into the search box on Google, it's where you also go online, the different websites you visit. That also can be quite revelatory. So having a browser, having a search engine that doesn't collect or share as much information about your searches can help. It's also helpful to have something like Privacy Badger that limits how much information can be collected about your browsing activity across lots of different websites, not just the search engine.
Where would we find Privacy Badger or one of the others?
I think the EFF website has Privacy Badger.
And for those listening, that's EFF.org.
Yes.
And it has links to various downloads, maybe not your own, but...
Yes. I'm not sure if it links to other companies' tools, but we do have guides for protecting your privacy online on our website as well.
Yeah, we have a really great guide called Surveillance Self-Defense. It's we call it SSD for short, and that has all kinds of digestible, short little tutorials on how to change your privacy settings or install different tools. So definitely urge people to go check that out.
And all of this is information that may be a year or two old. How does AI change all this? Is artificial intelligence creating a whole new world for this stuff?
There's two ways that artificial intelligence really makes a big role or really plays a big role here. One is the information that people are inputting into chatbots. That in itself can be extremely sensitive and private. But the other role that AI is playing in this space is actually on the company side in data analysis. And the more advanced the algorithms that the companies are using are, the more able they are to use all of the information that you leave when you visit any website, like your IP address and things like that. More advanced AI tools can help companies link all that information together to identify the user, even if they haven't, for example, allowed certain cookies that are expressly identifying to have been installed on the browser. So the more powerful the analytics tools are, the more companies can do with the information, whatever information they are able to get from each user, which can make the kinds of information that you have to send, right? You have to send an IP address often and things like that when you browse the internet, because that's how your browser communicates with other web servers, right? But the more powerful the analytics tools, the more powerful even that kind of information will be to companies who want to track you to identify your browsing habits, your online shopping habits, and things like that.
A listener just wrote in, messaged me about a well-known financial institution that has taken on a policy where if somebody uses a credit card they haven't used in a while, or for various other reasons sends up a red flag, their response is now going to be produce and upload photo ID. They want your photograph. They want information as far as your driver's license number or things that they haven't used before. His question is, how do you protect yourself in that instance? They've had their security breached before, and now you've got all this valuable information in it, driver's license numbers, passports, whatever it is they've asked for.
Sounds like a fraud to me, Jeffrey.
I mean, it's a real problem. Someone in my family had a similar problem with Facebook, that Facebook would sort of paused his account, and I don't know if you've heard of this story, actually, but wouldn't reinstate it unless he uploaded a photo ID, and he's like, I don't want to do that. We have a whole team that's working on age verification at EFF related to, and this gets more into the speech side, but there's a big privacy component where different states are trying to limit minors' access to sexual content or other supposedly harmful to minors content online. And that is basically either directly or indirectly requiring identity authentication companies to partner with different websites to verify the age of people, and that often involves also uploading ID and personal data like that, such as a driver's license or whatnot. And so we've been really trying to we and other organizations have been trying to flag that this is a huge privacy issue. Free speech issues aside, if we're uploading all of our pieces of identification with where we live and our identification numbers and things like that to these random third parties that may or may not be also sharing them with different websites and government agencies, it's just really it's a huge privacy mess to say it succinctly.
It might not even be coming from a real company. It might be coming from a fraud artist trying to get private information from you and then figure out a way to dip into your bank account or do some other thing to shake you down.
Well, that's true. I mean, we definitely see that happening. And maybe, Tori, I don't want to take your thunder, but we definitely see fraudsters emulate kind of regular processes, right? Sort of social engineering ways, right? To be like, oh, well, people are used to, for example, getting confirmation emails from Amazon, so therefore I'm going to send a fraudulent, email that looks like a confirmation email from Amazon. And anyways.
Well, AI makes that much easier, doesn't it?
There has been a rise in these sorts of phishing attacks thanks to the use of AI. It allows scam artists the ability to send out these kinds of emails and text messages much more quickly and personalize them to the people that they're sending them to. There's also been a rise of phone calls that are actually soliciting similar information, sometimes by mimicking the voice of someone connected to the person. And that has been also another big problem with the ability to generate.
Do you want to give us an example of that sort of phone call and what they sound like and what the people say?
There's all kinds of examples. One that I've heard a few times is they'll have a phone call mimicking someone's child or relative and sounding in distress, asking, I need money for whatever reason to do whatever, like something, some kind of emergency situation. There's always a sense of time urgency in these phone calls because people tend to throw down or cast aside their inhibitions a little bit more when they feel like they don't have much time to make a decision. So often it'll be using the voice of a child or another family member who say they need a certain amount of money this in a very limited time frame for some emergency reason. And often the victims of these calls will give them their credit card information or transfer money to the wrong account or things like that. And sometimes also people are using AI voice generators to mimic people's voices for verification purposes, to pass checks, for example, that some financial institutions have been used or had used for security purposes.
So tell me about some of the other pranks. Like, we know that one of the things we're hearing a lot of are the elderly getting calls about grandchildren that might need bail money, things of that nature. I know one who got a call recently was on the verge of helping to bail out her grandson when I pointed out she has granddaughters but no grandsons. But they can sound pretty convincing and pretty compelling.
Yes, unfortunately, a lot of these messages have been targeting the elderly for some, I mean, there are reasons, but unfortunately, elderly individuals are often more willing to comply with the scammer's requests. And this has been true since before these were happening on the computer. Before this, sometimes they were coming through the mail or the phone or things of that nature. So it's not a new type of scam, but it is on a bigger scale. And unfortunately, with so much information being aggregated and available, it's not particularly difficult to generate a list of people who have certain demographic characteristics, including age, which makes it easier for scammers to target people they think are more willing to or more likely to fall into the trap they're trying to lay.
And then, of course, there's the issue. How do they know this person at that age is out there?
Right. Yes, when so much information is being collected about so many people, it just increases the chances that it'll end up in the hands of someone who wants to do harm with it. So if this information, if all of this private information, including someone's age, their birthday, things like that, and their phone numbers, other kinds of contact information, maybe information about their family members, right? Whether they have grandchildren or not, things like that. Without all of this information being so readily available and aggregated into like easy to use profiles about people that you can just buy from data brokers and other people who buy and sell that kinds of information. Without that access, it would be much harder for people to target victims this precisely.
You know, I would like to circle back. We touched on something earlier that I don't think we fleshed out as well. Sophia, you had mentioned about getting a warrant and getting into certain data. And one thing we didn't flesh out is the difference between stored data and what they have a right to go and search for, as opposed to what's right in front of them, whether maybe you're sending a signal right now out on the internet, or maybe you've opened your computer to a page. Can you talk a little bit about how those are different?
Yeah, well, I think we touched on this with David's question, but yeah, typically for stored data, stored content, right? The government needs a warrant. There's other kinds of data, different metadata, you know, who are you communicating with, email addresses, call logs, that kind of thing, that is accessible on sort of with lesser legal process. But yeah, if it's sort of a live surveillance, typically then that's going to implicate the Wiretap Act. Which is sort of, sometimes we call it a sort of a super warrant because there's sort of various standards that are a little bit more protective than kind of just the traditional warrant process.
Even with cell phone data, it's quite different to actually track people and go back and find data as opposed to looking right now where they are.
It's more difficult. Sorry, say that again.
Legally, it's a bigger hurdle to jump over to.
Well, the Supreme Court, in this case called Carpenter, that dealt with cell site location information, that was retrospective data, and they said a warrant was required for that. But there hasn't been a clear case with sort of modern technology, as far as I know, that about, you know, prospective. But again, I think the existing statutes are fairly protective. But the challenge with this area of law is that technology is constantly evolving, and so there's always going to be a question of whether existing cases or existing statutes apply to, you know, evolving technology. And so that's what makes our job so much fun, is that we get to make those arguments to protect people's rights.
Unfortunately, it seems that the courts are evolving and not in the right direction as far as protecting our privacies.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go. I mean, with the current Chief Justice and under his guidance, you know, we have seen some good cases, at least maybe, you know, a decade or half a decade ago come out. But yeah, with this current iteration, you know, we could expand. We could expand notions of privacy, you know, such as abortion, for example, where clearly that didn't go, that went in the opposite direction. So, but yeah, in terms of digital privacy, it hasn't been terrible in the last decade or so. But, you know, there's always room for improvement, and there are lots of areas where the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in. So, for example, on the border search issue, the Supreme Court has not weighed there. I should say there are many, many Supreme Court, not many. There are a handful of Supreme Court decisions, pre-digital decisions related to border searches, but the Supreme Court has not yet taken up this issue as applied to digital devices. So we leave it up to the circuit courts, the federal appellate courts, to kind of fill in the holes. And unfortunately, when that happens, it ends up being very frequently a patchwork of laws. So, for example, on the border search issue, you have the Ninth Circuit for the Western states and the Fourth Circuit for the Eastern and Mid-Atlantic states that have much better rules under the Fourth Amendment that have circumscribed CBP's authority to search devices. But lots of the other circuits have deferred to the government. And so you really have inconsistent law across the nation. So what airport you land in will determine what rules CBP is supposed to follow under the Fourth Amendment, and it really shouldn't be that way. It should be ideally one standard rule across the country. And so, again, on the border search issue, we've advocated for and are continuing to hope that legislation, if the courts don't fill in the gaps and the Supreme Court doesn't take this up, that legislation will, and at the congressional level, will protect people's privacy.
There's an entirely technical aspect to what you all are working with, and you all are fairly well versed in what the technical terms are and what the computers and the cloud and all of these things do. What's the lawyer's role in educating the courts and the public and the other lawyers about these things, and how do you help them to present these things so that the courts can digest these things in a meaningful and accurate way?
That's one thing EFF is particularly interested in doing. We work with a team of technologists who help us first understand the technology and the issues and how they might relate to our case, and then help us present those in a way that courts and the public would understand. So it doesn't just fall on the lawyers, but we think that's an incredibly important part of our job, because part of the way that you make sure technology doesn't erode civil liberties over time is to understand exactly how that technology works and how it will impact those civil liberties. So that way you can intervene at those points and protect the rights.
So can you give an example of how you're doing that or what you've done in the past in that way? Go ahead.
Sure. I think one example would be in some of our, I think, privacy work. This isn't necessarily advocating to courts, but we have tried to explain we've written policy papers, white papers, and blog posts that were public facing, explaining how, for example, consumer surveillance tracking technologies, things like cookies, pixels, and things like that are being how they work when users visit websites, and then how that technology feeds into a surveillance ecosystem where information is being bought and sold and aggregated about individuals.
Yeah, I can add. I mean, I wrote a brief or worked on with my colleagues last year or the year before. We just had to explain what a URL was because this was actually a speech case, but I won't get into the details. But essentially, we came in as amicus, but the opposing side, the side that we were opposing, was trying to argue that it was somehow like some sort of volitional act on the part of the website. And we had to say, no, like URLs are just like fundamental to the architecture of the internet. And it's not a thing that is created by some website because they feel like creating it. It's a thing that's absolutely necessary. And that was trying to educate the court and explain how that worked was absolutely critical to then sort of debunking the opposing arguments. So sometimes it just gets down to some really fundamental technical explanations like that.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, and I did offer each of you about a minute if you'd like to add any remarks or if you want to tell people where they can go for information or help.
If you'd like more information on digital privacy issues and how you can protect yourself online or at the border, please visit EFF.org. Which is EFF's website. We are a member-supported organization and would appreciate your support as well.
Yep, we can't do the work that we do without the support of our very generous members, and we are fighting for your rights, so we, as Tori said, we welcome your support.
And one thing that I've always appreciated about the Electronic Frontier Foundation is how far ahead you are looking. And there were times 30, 35 years ago where you were looking at issues and many of us shrugged and thought, what's that all about? Why are you looking at that? And here we are a short time later, and it's so fundamental. You're looking a bit further down the road than just about anybody.
We try. Yeah, we actually are celebrating our 35th anniversary this summer, so we're having a special campaign online, and we have lots of new stickers and swag, sweatshirts and t-shirts, and so check them out.
And I would encourage that, EFF.org. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we've been discussing privacy in the digital age. Our guests tonight have been Sophia Cope and Tori Noble from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Produced in conjunction with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we hope tonight's show is the first of many together. Next week, attorney John O'Grady will explain why probate law is not about property, it's about people. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guests and to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. For tonight's co-host, David Begeleisen, and at the controls, Marla Davies, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, be safe, and zealously guard your legal rights.